Welcome to today's program titled Washington's Paid Family and Medical Leave Law. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our host for today's call, Jillian Murphy. You may begin.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us as we all are preparing for 2020, in particular, the paid family and medical leave law. With me are my colleagues, Kate, Tylee Hertz, and Angela Vogel. And between the three of us, we've been working really hard on trying to get everybody ready for this new law, getting questions answered directly from the state, sometimes getting more than one answer directly from the state. But we're hopeful today that we can give you a little bit of an overview and then share some answers we've received lately and some tips for what you need to do for the rest of the year and beyond. So we do have that chat or that question and answer section there where you can submit questions. We have a lot of material to get through, so we're probably not going to be able to address those questions as we go, but we're going to save some time at the end of the program to answer some of those questions. And then what we thought we'd do, if we get enough interest and enough questions that we aren't probably able to answer during this session, is we might have another session later in the year where we really just focus on questions and answers. So let us know if that sounds like something you'd like to participate in. And with that, let's get started. So today, as I mentioned, we are going to do an overview, just kind of a shorter overview. Some of you I know have joined us before, and hopefully this isn't the first time you've heard about this program, but if it is, that's okay. We'll kind of go over the basics. I think one of the areas that really generates the most questions is how this new paid family medical leave program is going to intersect with the other 15 other leave laws that already exist here in Washington and federally. So we're going to talk a lot about that. We've had some amendments and some rulemaking that we'll go over that have answered some questions and then raised new questions. And then finally, kind of some top tips for preparing for 2020. And if somebody out there in the listening land can shoot me a little hello or a question to get going, I'd love to make sure that that section is working. Oh, there they all are. Great. Fantastic. And I see some friendly faces out there. Great. All right. So, basic overview. So this is a statewide insurance plan. And I think thinking of it as an insurance plan has been kind of helpful to kind of wrap your head around what this is. It's kind of similar to your unemployment insurance. It requires employers to report wages, hours worked, and additional information quarterly. So very similar to your unemployment quarterly reports through the ESD, and it's the ESD, the Employment Security Department, that is sort of an offshoot of that is running this program. You're going to be reporting things on a quarterly basis. Some of you have hopefully already done that. And then, so this program is basically funded by premiums that are going to be paid by employees. And if you're a large enough employer, and we'll talk about this, the employer is going to be kicking in cash to this program as well. The premiums, have you already been collecting those from your employees or at least covering those on behalf of your employee? That started this past January. So all year we're collecting the premiums and submitting those premiums to the state. And then those benefits are going to become available to eligible employees starting next year on January 1. And then the general concept is that eligible employees will receive up to 12 weeks of some amount of wage replacement if they're taking time off for one of these covered purposes, with some or potentially a lot of exceptions. All right, so who must comply? So it's basically most employers that have employees in Washington. Unlike some programs, even small businesses have to comply with this. Nonprofits have to comply with this, various charities, religious organizations. There's only a few exceptions, and it's you can see them there on the slide, federal employees. Oh, it sounds like, and I just want to make sure it sounds like there's some some audio issues, but hopefully somebody's figuring that out. So hang tight. So there are some exceptions, and you can see them there. All right. I'm going to keep going. All right. Moving right along. And by the way, you might be asking the question, well, what if I'm an employer that is out of state, but I have employees in Washington? Yep, you're covered. What if I'm an employer that has employees who maybe work in two different states? There's kind of some specific rules on that. And if that's you, we should talk offline about that. And if somebody could just give me a heads up, if I should just continue, am I being heard here? Oh, look, some people are asking questions. I'm going to just keep going. All right. Sorry, folks. Hang tight. Okay, great. Shelly can hear me. Fantastic. All right. So who's eligible to receive these benefits? So it's all employees who have worked at least 820 hours for any employer in Washington during the qualifying period. That's not 820 hours for their current employer. It's any employer in the qualifying period, which is defined there, you can see, as the first four of the last five completed calendar quarters, or the last four from the date the leave begins. Sounds probably pretty similar to unemployment. You know, there's that kind of four quarter out of five quarter look back. So as long as you've worked 820 hours for any employer in Washington, you're eligible for these benefits. Hours can be worked, again, for more than one Washington employer. If you're working part-time for more than one employer, all those add up to get you to that 820 threshold. All right, what is covered? So, qualifying events, medical leave, that's the M in the PFML, for an employee's own serious health condition. That might sound familiar to the FMLA, because it is. So if I have a serious health condition, I'm going to be eligible to get benefits for my own self if I'm not able to work because of that condition. And the family leave side of it is caring for a family member who has a serious health condition, or some of those parental leave purposes, such as bonding with a baby after adoption, birth, fostering a child under 18 years old. And then there's also certain military-connected events that you can apply for benefits for. The big kicker here is that the definition of family member is much more broad than it is under the FMLA. And we'll do a comparison down the road, but you can see here in bold, siblings, grandparents, in-laws, there's just going to be a lot more options for folks to take that family leave to care for a family member when all these other people are included as a family. All right, how does it work? So for all leaves except birth or placement of a child, so birth or adoption or fostering, in order to be able to apply and get benefits, there's a 7-day waiting period before an employee is eligible for PFML benefits. Might sound similar to like an STD plan that you have. So there's going to be that waiting period, and there's a little more discussion about that later in the program. After you've reached that or satisfied that waiting period to receive benefits, the employee is going to go ahead and file a claim directly with the state. And there's some sort of online portal, you may have heard of this, that they'll be able to do that through. The employee does have an obligation to notify the employer, but then really it's the state that's going to determine whether that employee is eligible. There's eligibility requirements such as that minimum hours worked, that's that 820 hours thing. And then the state's going to decide if the reason you need to be gone from work is truly a qualifying event, given all the definitions of serious health conditions. So the state's probably going to ask for medical records. They're going to ask for different things to determine whether that employee is eligible for those benefits. If the ESD approves the application, the ESD pays the benefit directly to the employee. So it's really, you know, the state's kind of handling it all, just like they do for unemployment. Now, there's going to be some coordination between the state and the employer. The state may ask the employer for information, verifying that that person works there, those kinds of things. And the employer may want to get some information from the state. So not super clear how much information is going to be going back and forth. But for the most part, the employee and the state just kind of handle this directly with each other. The minimum claim duration payment is currently 8 consecutive hours, but this may change. So unlike the FMLA where you can take, you know, a half hour off here, an hour here, the minimum amount of hours that an employee can claim is 8. Now, the state has clarified for us, because of course, my question being potentially a little bit of a, you know, I've been doing this a long time. Well, how, you know, is an employee who needs 2 hours off to go to a medical appointment for a serious health condition, are they just going to say, well, I just need the whole day off so that they can get those 8 hours? The state has said that they are going to do their best to make sure that employees are only getting benefits if they actually need to be absent because of that condition for a full 8 hours. There's other issues involved. You know, a lot of questions have come up, and I bet they're coming in right now about, well, what about somebody only works a 6-hour shift and they need to miss a whole day? They're not really missing 8 consecutive hours. How does that work? Does that count? What about a 10-hour shift? There's still some questions that we're trying to sort out with kind of that intermittent leave. But for now, what we know is there's an 8-hour consecutive hour minimum duration. All right. How are the premiums paid? So these are the premiums that the employer is submitting to the state to fund the program. Employers, since January 1 of this year, have been collecting, or some employers are choosing to cover, covering the amount of money that the employees are supposed to kick in. But a lot of employers are collecting those premiums from employees' paychecks. Now, this is not optional. Employees can't say, hey, I don't want to do this. This is required, just like, you know, any other the other deductions we might take from employees. So they've been kicking that in. And then employers with 50 or more employees also have some additional money to kick in towards the program. And we'll break that down a little bit further on another slide. Small businesses, less than 50 employees, and that's in Washington, by the way, not worldwide, are not required to pay towards the premium, but they can choose to. And then employers will just go ahead and submit those premiums on a quarterly basis. Now, you may have become aware that the first couple of quarters were delayed, but right now people are in the process of submitting the premiums for the first part of the year. So hopefully folks are having an okay time doing that through the portal. And then just a shout out to folks. Some folks have voluntary plans. I think we learned there's about 300 approved voluntary plans in Washington right now. So that's folks who, employers who already have really generous benefits, and they're just choosing to kind of self-fund all that. So we'll talk a little bit about that later. So how much are we kicking in? So the total premium is, you know, the starting place is 0.4% of the employee's gross pay. And you can find statistics online. I think with somebody making about $50,000 or $60,000 a year, it's about $4 a week, something along those lines. But a third of that, 0.4%, a third of that goes technically is allocated to the family leave. Two-thirds of it is allocated to the medical leave portion of this program. Now, that's not something that employers or employees ever really have to keep track of, but that's how the state is funding these two buckets of leave. Now, employers with at least 50 employees, again, those larger employers, are going to pay 37% of the premium, so 37% of that 0.4% of wages. And then the employees pick up the remainder, that 63%. But for smaller employers, it's just going to be the employee portion. So that 63% of the 0.4, you'll go ahead and collect that from employees and submit that, but the employer doesn't have to kick in that extra 37%. So there's just less going in on behalf of those employees who are employed by smaller employers. And yes, there's lots of questions about, this doesn't sound like enough money going in to fund these things. And there are some concerns about this program being underfunded, and we'll just have to wait and see on that. All right, intersection with other laws. I mean, this is the part. I mean, the program, you know, they're it's pretty set straightforward. How much is the premium? How much time to get up? All those kinds of things. But what I think has been the trickiest thing for us and our clients to figure out is how this law is going to interact with all the other different types of laws out there. So we're sort of sorting through this. We've gotten some answers. We've got some strategies around some of this, but it's going to continue to be an interesting thing to see play out. So let's look at some of those. Let's remind ourselves what some of the other laws out there. So the FMLA is the big one, right? So that's something we've all, our big employers have all been dealing with, but it's really interesting to look at the differences. So the FMLA, that's the Federal Medical Family Leave Act. So that kicks in only for employees who have worked for that single employer, for their own employer, at least 1,250 hours in the prior 12 months and for a whole year. So if I'm an employee, I have to work for a whole year for one employer before I'm eligible to take FMLA. And it's only for larger employers, those who employ 50 or more employees. Now, PFML, the state version, is super different. Pretty much all employees are eligible to take it. So long as they've been employed in Washington for not that long, 820 hours and four quarters, then they're eligible. And it doesn't matter if they've only worked for you for 2 weeks. They can go ahead and apply to get these benefits. So that's a huge difference regarding the employee's eligibility. Now, one thing that this we don't talk a lot about, but there's going to be a difference between whether the leave is considered protected or not. So if you've got an employee who's only worked for you for less than a year, so they're not also eligible for FMLA, then they may be eligible to go and get those premiums from the state to cover their absence, but there's no obligation to reinstate that employee once they're no longer off work. And it's going to be tricky because employees are going to have a hard time understanding that, but you know, if you've got a brand new employee and they need to go take 12 weeks off for a surgery, you got to think about some other leave laws there, but you may not have an obligation to bring them back, and they still could go and get those benefits, but they just might not have a job when they come back. If though they are eligible for the FMLA because they've worked for you for a year and they've met those requirements and you're a large enough employer, then that leave would be protected. And so you would need to reinstate them. All right. Covered purposes. So also just kind of looking at the differences here. FMLA, it's going to be a serious health condition. The state version, also a serious health condition. And the definitions are pretty much identical there. For the federal version, it's family leave. Again, the reasons you can take both the medical or the family leave are the same for the most part under the federal and state versions. It's just that that definition of family is super expanded. So you're just going to be able to take leave caring for your grandparent-in-law, whereas in the FMLA, it's really quite a bit smaller, and we'll see that right here. Who is a family member? So you'll see here under the FMLA, it's pretty narrow: child, parent, spouse, domestic partner. But under the state version, it's going to look a lot more like the paid sick leave laws. So it's going to be siblings and grandparents and grandchildren and even in-laws. So you just have a much broader definition, which means more people are going to be able to take time off for more reasons. Comparing again between the federal and state versions, the duration of leave under the FMLA, it's 12 work weeks in a 12-month period. And that's it. Under the state version, again, it's going to be 12 work weeks or 16 work weeks if the employee needs both family and medical leave. So in a 12-month period, I had the need to be absent for my own serious health condition. And then I also later had a need to be absent to take care of a child or to take care of a family member or to bond with a newborn. So if you've got a combined need in the year for both family and medical, you're going to get a total of 16 weeks, split however you want to do it. 18 weeks, if it's a pregnant employee who has a serious health condition resulting in incapacity. And that 18 weeks might sound a little bit familiar because that was how it worked when the state version of the Family Medical Leave Act and the Pregnancy Disability stacked. We've still got some outstanding questions on that piece, but that's the general framework. Again, funding. FMLA was a right to be out of work on an unpaid basis. you might be able to use some PTO or some short-term disability, but it was an unpaid leave. Obviously, the whole point of the paid family medical leave is that it's paid. And you'll see there that it's $1,000 a week max. It works out to be 90-ish percent of an employee's weekly wages up to a cap of $1,000 a week. And finally, you know, here, let's not forget about some of our other favorite Washington laws relating to leave. You've got the Washington Family Leave Act. Now, that was the state version of the FMLA. Now, that is going away. That is sunsetting, and the paid family version is in its place. We still, though, have the Washington Family Care Act. Remember, that's the one where if you do provide paid leave to employees, you have to allow them to access that paid leave to care for a family member. Not quite sure how that is going to intersect. We're going to talk about supplemental benefits later in the program and some strategies on how you can kind of put some parameters on that. If somebody's taking some money from the state and also taking PTO, will those parameters be okay under the Washington Family Care Act is something that we don't know yet. Domestic violence leave, that's a right to be gone on an unpaid basis. You've also got your general, if somebody's disabled, you may need to let them be absent from work. Pregnancy disability accommodation is still there. Again, that's a right to be away from work on an unpaid basis for as long as you're disabled. Some real questions around how that one's going to intersect with the paid state program. And then workers' compensation and then paid sick leave. So you've got a lot of leave laws to think about on a state basis, and then you've got your federal ones there on the other side. And with that, let's get into it a little bit more specifically. Angela will talk about the amendments in phase six rules.
Thanks, Jillian. Yeah, so there's been a lot of changes with these 2019 amendments, and we have some draft phase six rules that address the amendments. So the amendments address supplemental benefits, waiting periods, and voluntary plans. And so I'll talk a little bit about each of these and what the changes look like. So with the 2019 amendments, employers now have the option of providing supplemental benefits to employees. And so essentially they can now top off the partial wage replacement that the PFML is going to provide with PTO, vacation, and sick time. And this was initially prohibited by the prior version of the law. So this is great. Employers can now offer this top off to employees. And the reason this changed, how it changed within the law, is the definition of wages was changed. And essentially, it now includes compensation or remuneration paid by an employer to an employee. And remuneration is basically that compensation for services provided. But there's a carve-out within that definition that says that, that payment of tips and also supplemental benefit payments made from an employer to an employee are not included in that definition of wages and compensation. So now employers have the option of offering these supplemental benefits to employees while they're out on PFML leave. And I'll talk more about that in a minute and with regards to the phase six rules. But there's also some amendments or changes to waiting periods and voluntary plans. There was some confusion around how the waiting period was going to work as the law was previously written. And with the amendment, we now know that the waiting period is 7 consecutive calendar days, not 7 days of leave. And the waiting period starts once an employee's out for a PFML qualifying reason for at least 8 hours currently. So once that employee's out for 8 hours, their waiting period starts, and then they'll be eligible to use leave. One thing to note here is the waiting period doesn't apply for birth or placement of a child. And what's interesting is with the there was just a new draft of the draft phase six rules that was filed. And in the prior draft, in the definition section, there was a definition of waiting period. But when I look at the new draft, I don't see that waiting period definition there. So we're going to be following up with the state on that to get more information on that piece. And then with regards to voluntary plans, previously employers couldn't offer voluntary plans to employees until they met eligibility requirements. So they had to be you know, working 820 hours within the state and then 340 hours for that employer before they'd be eligible for the employer's voluntary plan. There were a few little exceptions to that. But with the amendment, now employers can come, employees can come to the employer on day one and be eligible for voluntary plans. So that gives employers some more flexibility in offering those plan benefits to employees. So the draft phase six rules are what provide the definition of supplemental benefits. Interestingly, the definition isn't within the law, it's within these draft rules. And the draft rules haven't yet been finalized. They're supposed to be finalized in December 2019, so right before employees can start taking these benefits. And supplemental benefits are defined as a payment offered by an employer to an employee who's taking leave, PFML leave. And they include things like salary continuation, vacation time, sick time, or other paid time off. What's really significant about these rules and about supplemental benefits, as we know now, is that employers can offer this paid time off, these supplemental benefits, but there's no requirement that they do so. So these are, you know, extra. They're not legally required. It's something that employers can provide. But it's the employee's choice whether or not they can use any supplemental benefits. So the employee can say, oh, sure, I'll use my PTO while I'm out on PFML leave. Or they could say, no, first I'm going to, you know, use my PTO for whatever reason, and then I'm going to go to the state and I'm going to apply for my PFML benefits. So it gives the employees a lot of discretion as to what that leave will look like for them. And significantly, it's also different than under the FMLA. And let's talk a little bit more about that. So under the FMLA, employers can require that employees use available PTO, vacation time, sick time that's not protected paid sick leave while they're on FMLA leave. So if the employee's available paid time off will be running concurrently with that FMLA leave. This is not permitted under the PFML, under those draft supplemental benefit rules. The employee has the right to choose whether or not they can use that supplemental benefit. So in our discussions with the state, you know, we've talked about, well, what happens if that employee's out on PFML leave, state leave, but they're also out for an FMLA qualifying reason. What happens under the FMLA, the employer can require the use of that available paid time off, but under the state law, they can't. And the state has said that it remains the employee's choice while they're on PFML leave. So that's going to be an interesting issue for employers to handle, and you're going to want to take a look at your policies as well to make sure that those updates are there. Interestingly enough, with regards to the FMLA as well, there's going to be situations where an employee may be qualified for both FMLA leave and state leave, but the leaves won't run concurrently, and that the state has taken the position that you can't require that employees apply for PFML leave. So if you can't require that they apply for that leave, you know, they may opt to first take FMLA leave and then wait a while and then later apply for their state benefits. So there's going to be some interesting scenarios that we're going to deal with. Hopefully we get more guidance from the state on this. Right now there's not a lot by way of rules or other guidance. And then with regards to the supplemental benefits amounts and reporting, the draft rules that we currently have say that these payments are excluded from wages. So because they're not wages, they don't have to be reported to the state. And so the state has said that they're not going to monitor the employer's benefit plans that it provides as far as available PTO, vacation time, other paid leave, because that's outside of their scope. And it also means that because these supplemental benefits are excluded from wages and are not reportable to the state, that the amount paid by an employer won't reduce an employee's weekly benefit amount. So This means there's a potential here where an employee could receive, you know, they're out for 8 hours taking their leave, they get 8 hours of their PTO, a supplemental benefit, and then they're also getting their partial wage replacement from the state potentially. So their amount of money they're receiving, their compensation they're receiving from supplemental benefits and from the partial wage replacement could possibly be greater than their regular wages. We don't have a lot of information on this right now. The draft rules don't specify whether or not there's a ceiling on the amount of supplemental benefits, but it's a developing area, and hopefully we know more soon. And I think I'm going to hand it over to Kate now to talk about some top tips for 2020 based on all these new developments.
Great. Thanks, Angela. And I want to touch on the questions that are coming in are really, really great questions. We'll have time today to cover some of them, but I do think that it lends to having another webinar in more of a Q&A fashion toward the end of the year, especially since we don't have a lot of clear guidance on some of these issues as of today. So just want to keep those questions coming in. There's some really great ones. So let's get you ready for 2020. We'll go over the top 10 tips as they exist today on what we believe you should be doing to get ready for 2020. Tip number one, double check those deductions. So as you all probably know, the deductions needed to start at the beginning of 2019. They must be pulled from employee paychecks for the employee portion. At that particular time, you cannot go back if you under withhold and ask them for more money. Additionally, if you haven't been taking deductions, and so some companies have said, you know, this isn't a huge amount right now, depending on the size of the company, we will go ahead and cover it for our employees for the time being. That's completely fine to do. An employer can always be more generous, can cover the employee portion, but let's say you then have a pretty rapid growth or decide, you know, budget-wise, it's not a feasible decision moving forward. If you do that, that's fine as well, but you must provide employees with at least 2 weeks' written notice prior to taking the deduction. So that was not necessary if you started January 1, 2019, but if you do that moving forward, you do need to give them those 2 weeks' written notice. So tip one, make sure those deductions are correct and you're withholding the right amounts from your employees. Tip number two, prepare for quarterly reporting. So what is today? We're nearing the end of September. As you may know, looking at a calendar, quarter one and quarter two have long passed us. They had originally said, since this is our first year and they're kind of ironing out some things, that employers had the ability to report for quarter one and quarter two through July 31. Then those of you who were monitoring this maybe realized, oh, the portal's not quite ready. So they then extended that to the end of August, and it has now been extended to the end of September. So if you have not reported yet, that's okay. You should report soon. What I will share from the state on this is that they say it is now open. Quarterly reporting was due the end of August, but there's some additional language on the website saying you're fine to report through the end of September and will not be subject to any penalties. They have also reported some technical glitches. The known technical glitches are that at times the report status will get stuck in submitted. There's additional information on their website if you run into that issue. The second issue is that account balances are not updating to reflect submitted payments. And so those are known issues by ESC. If you're experiencing difficulties when you do your reporting, there's more information on the website and you can reach out to ESC directly. They've also provided the quarterly reporting checklist to walk you through step-by-step on how to do the reporting. Information to report, business information, as well as employee-specific information. And then they walk you through the actual process, how to log in, how to get an account, have your UBI number on hand, set up your account, and then how to do the reporting. There's also a very nice video. I thought about playing it for us all, but it's about 6 minutes. So if you go to the ESD website, there's a really great video that walks you through step-by-step on how to do the reporting if you haven't done that yet. So tip number two, get those reports in. The portal's up and running. Tip three, don't forget about voluntary plans. For any of you who've been on our presentations before, you know that you probably know I love voluntary plans. I find them pretty fascinating. But we also had feedback in the past to say, let's wait and see what happens in 2019 with the amendments before you make a decision on whether to opt for a voluntary plan or go through the state program. The reason being, as Angela discussed in detail, is this top-off issue with supplemental benefits. What happens if you already have leave benefits that provide paid leave to your employees for different reasons, for their own medical conditions, for family-related, for parental leave? What do you do and how do you reconcile the state program with your own existing benefits? The answer from the state on that is, okay, well, you can have a voluntary plan. You can not pay into the state program, but submit something to the state to show that you're providing at least what the state program provides. Given that the top-off is at the discretion of the employee, this is something to really take a look at now before we get to 2020. It's going to be a way for employers to control how much leave employees take. For example, like Angela said, if you have an employee who has, say you have a 10-week parental leave policy, paid full salary, and an employee says, oh, there's this new program rolling out, I'm going to take my 10 weeks paid leave, and then I will access the state program. You now have an employee that could potentially be out half of the year. And so by moving this into a voluntary plan, if you already have existing leave benefits that are close to meeting the state requirements, it's worth taking a look at now before we get to 2020. For those of you here today that have existing voluntary plans, a quick reminder that there is a requirement that you get reapproval each year for the first, I believe, 3 years that your voluntary plan is in place. We talked to ESD about this particular issue, and they assured us that they are going to be contacting you to work through that process. So there's nothing that you need to do proactively if you have a voluntary plan in place right now until the state reaches out to you. They said that even if that isn't until 2020, they're pretty busy right now. If it's not until 2020, you're totally fine. We have the word from ESD on that. But keep an eye on that. If you haven't seen anything from ESD as the year comes to a close, maybe reach out and just double check that you didn't miss something in the mail. So tip three, keep an eye on those voluntary plans. Tip number four, communicate with your employees. Really making sure that employees understand both the deduction, and by now they probably all do, and also if you make that change, giving them the 2 weeks written notice, but also just, you know, keeping an eye on this for your employees, making sure that you have good, clear communication with your employees. An additional thing to keep in mind is that deduction amount may increase as years go on. Mathematically, we see that maybe this is a little bit underfunded. I'm no mathematician, but it doesn't look like a whole lot of money is going into this program based on the 0.4 gross. So communication is key, making sure your employees know that may change, and it could change as early as next year. And so our recommendation would be keep an eye on that amount, and if it does increase, make sure your employees are aware of it so they don't see more coming out of their paychecks. And there's a sample email as well that's available from ESD, as well as a pay stub insert. So some good stuff from ESD to help with those communications. Tip number five, we are almost through rulemaking. So phases 1 through 5 are now final. And as Angela said, the phase 6 rules that deal with the amendments that were passed this year, as well as appeals, those are set to be finalized by about December 20th. So we'll have 11 days between then and when people start taking leave. Plenty of time. And then they've also added this section of ongoing rulemaking for privacy rules. We're not really sure what that means, but keep an eye on rulemaking. ESD has been really great at taking feedback, at really listening to concerns that employers have, that employees have, and making changes when necessary. And so be proactive. If you have an issue with something in Phase 6 rules, know that there's still time to weigh in on that. There'll be public hearings in November, and it's never too late to have a voice on this. Tip number 6, don't be afraid to contact DSD. That was a nice segue. They're really responsive. Sometimes you get different information from different people you contact. If that happens, I suggest reaching out to them again and flagging it for them that that you are receiving inconsistent feedback. Or, you know, if you work with us, you can always contact us or contact your employment counsel and have them reach out to ESD on your behalf. We're always happy to do that. We've established some good contacts at ESD, and they're extremely helpful when we have some pretty tricky situations come up on behalf of our clients. Train your human resources and your managers. So this is going to really change the landscape in Washington. We're going to have all these overlapping leaves. We're going to have laws that intersect in different ways. We're going to have employers who have never had to keep an eye on the FMLA and now have to monitor something that has some similarities to the FMLA. And so it's really key that we familiarize our managers and anyone who's going to be working with this program to make sure that they understand the basics of it and they understand when to loop in HR and how to handle these tricky situations. Really quick on the FMLA piece, the one interesting thing I find with this, well, one of the interesting things, is that under the FMLA, you have the 50 employees limited to a 75-mile radius. PFML extends that, so it's any employer that has 50 or more employees in the state of Washington. So we don't have that 75-mile radius. We now have the state as our geographical range. So just being mindful of that, if you have 50 employees in Washington, even if they're spread all over the state, that those the job protection piece is going to kick in, that you'll be treated more like an FMLA-covered employer. And our recommendation would be to plan for the trainings at the end of 2019 or really at the start of 2020. You know, it's difficult getting things scheduled as we come into the holiday season. But realistically, you know, planning on training in January 2020 would probably be the best course of action to make sure everyone's on the same page. Tip 8, look at those handbooks and policies. You know, we recommend doing a comprehensive review of your handbook, flagging those policies that potentially intersect with PFML. The Family Leave Act is going to sunset, so making sure that's pulled out of your handbook going into 2020. Also look at your short-term disability, long-term disability policies if you have them. What's the overlap there, and does it make sense to really look at, you know, maybe modifying that, maybe modifying your existing leave policies, and going to the state with an application for a voluntary plan? We talked to them recently about, you know, kind of what the flow has been on the applications for voluntary plans. It's been slow and steady this year. So they had, you know, a surge at the end of last year to get them approved by January 1, 2019. And now they say they trickle in. But the review process, they're turning them around fairly quickly. Sometimes there's a lot of back and forth to try to work between ESD and the employer to get a compliant policy. So there may be some back and forth, but they said that the turnaround can be as quick as 2 weeks right now. So keep that in mind when you review your existing policies as well as your short-term disability plan. And then our recommendation would be to draft a PFML policy that you would have in your handbook communicated to employees by the start of 2020. Our recommendation is kind of, you know, to work at that and work on that in draft form for the next couple of weeks or a couple of months, but really look at the start of December for finalizing that policy. Tip number 9, prepare for your employees to take leave. As you know, starting January 1, employees who have worked 820 hours in the qualifying period may apply to take leave. Those 820 hours can be worked for any employer in Washington. And so you have somebody moving from Connecticut, they've worked 820 hours in the last calendar year, but it was for an employer in a totally different state. They're not going to meet that eligibility requirement. But let's say you have an employee that's had three different jobs in the state of Washington. they're meeting that 820 hours, they're going to be able to apply to take the leave. It's cumulative regardless of the number of employers or jobs somebody had. If you do not have a voluntary plan, then that employee will apply directly to the state. There's also an obligation of the employee to notify you, and the state will also notify you when they get an inquiry from the employee. And then again, on the rulemaking, making sure you're weighing in. One thing to flag for preparing for employees to take leave is a common question we get is what you do if you have an employee who's pregnant who's set to give birth in 2019. What happens with that? Are they going to be eligible? And the answer is yes, they'll be eligible to take that leave. You know, if you have an employee who already gave birth this year, for example, if they meet that eligibility requirement of 820 hours in the qualifying period, even if they've come back to work since the birth of their child, if January 1, they're still within 12 months of the birth or placement of that child, they are going to be eligible to take the leave. So be mindful of that. There's been, I know, some different advice given by ESC on that issue, but they're really going to focus on those 820 hours on whether or not somebody can take the leave. And that's not just for pregnancy and childbirth, but that would be the one that is triggered by 12 months, so birth of placement within the 12 months of the child. So say somebody has surgery the last week of December and they're out, they're going to be able to take that leave for that existing condition. Tip number 10, post the required poster. You may be thinking, what required poster? It's not out yet, so you don't have to worry about this one yet. There may be a penalty if you don't post it, but we don't have the poster, so you can table this one for now. They have said they hope to have it by the end of the year, but put your poster up when it does come out. All right, and we'll turn it over to questions.
Great. Thanks, Kate. So there's been a lot of questions. I think some of them may have gotten answered along the way, and some of them are probably a little too detailed to answer here. But I think we can just start picking through these. I mean, I think what I'm seeing a lot of questions are is sort of this, when does the FMLA and the PFML run concurrently? And I just think the important thing to understand here is it sort of depends on when the employee applies for those benefits. So if an employee goes to the state and applies for those state benefits, and they're also eligible for FMLA at that time, then the state's going to pay those benefits and that FMLA clock is going to start to run. So at that point, if it's, you know, for a covered purpose and all the FMLA eligibility stuff is met and all the PFML stuff eligibility is met, then that leave of absence, during that leave of absence, the PFML and the FMLA will run concurrently. However, the state has made clear that when someone comes to them and requests PFML benefits, the state doesn't care whether they've taken leave in the last 12 months under the FMLA or for any other purpose. All the state's going to look at is, have they worked 820 hours in the last four quarters? Great, here's your benefits. And coupled with the fact that an employer can't force an employee to go to the state for and get those benefits for an eligible purpose, the situation you'll run into is an employee could say, hey, employer, I'm having some surgery and I want to take time off. And the employer will need to evaluate that under the FMLA and say, all right, well, it's a serious health condition. You've got 12 work weeks of unpaid leave. The employer can't say you need to go apply for your state benefits at the same time so that it runs concurrently. The employer just has to grant that FMLA, and if the employee is willing to take that time off as unpaid or potentially supplement with whatever else you're offering, then after those 12 work weeks are over and my FMLA is exhausted, if I've got another issue down the road in the year, maybe now I'm having a baby, I can then go to the state and say, hey, state, now I want my paid family medical leave benefits for 12 weeks. And the state doesn't care if you've already exhausted the FMLA for other reasons. The state just cares if you're eligible. And by the way, that leave will be protected too, because the employee meets, it's working for a large employer with 50 employees in the state, yada, yada. So in that scenario, the employee will have taken 12 protected work weeks of FMLA for a surgery and 12 protected work weeks of PFML for a pregnancy or something in the same 12-month rolling period. And there's not a lot we can do to force the employee to go to the state first so that those leaves will run concurrently. And so I see a lot of questions kind of, so how much do I tell a pregnant lady? How much time will she get off? And it really kind of depends on whether that pregnant lady is going to try to stack the leaves or not. And so that's kind of the tricky thing. And we can talk a little bit more about that at our next webinar. But some of the things, you know, that you can do may, you know, encouraging. So, for example, one of the things we think we can do, and Angela and Kate, feel free to weigh in here. But if the employee comes to you and says, hey, I just want to take my PTO or my FMLA for this issue that you know would probably be covered by the state, you could say, okay, well, your FMLA clock's going to run. That's, you know, federally, we got to do that. But as far as accessing PTO, we're only going to give you, you know, 2 hours a day, or put some sort of, you know, because we're going to assume that you could go get some additional funding from the state if you wanted to. Not telling you that you have to, but we're going to assume that you know, that you could. So some things we might be able to do to kind of encourage employees to get their state benefits earlier. Kate and Angela, do you have anything else to weigh in on kind of that conundrum that is coming up in the questions a lot?
Yeah, and To add on to that, I would echo what Jillian says as far as you still have control over your own leave policies. The state isn't going to interfere with you being more generous than what the program requires. However, they have the option to top off. So how do we control that? We can't force them to top off. We can't force them to take state leave, but you can modify your own leave policies to put limitations on it, you know, whether that be a limitation on hours per day or a limitation on, you know, how many weeks out of the year they can be out of the office while still making sure you build in protections for, you know, FMLA or other job protection if they have it. And so it'll take some creativity to really look at your leave policies and make sure that they don't cross a line. But the state's been clear. They don't intend to interfere with your own leave policies.
Right. I see another question about, this is an important one, will we be obligated as the employer to advise an employee of the PFML when they apply for FMLA? And there actually is a requirement to notify employees, not necessarily when they apply for FMLA, but just if you become aware, and I'll have to dig out that specific rule, but it's kind of similar to, you know, we are, I think, FMLA employers, we know that we're supposed to proactively say, hey, you might be eligible for the FMLA if you've been out for more than 3 days or whatever it is. So there will be some sort of notification requirement there.
Hey, Jillian, this is Angela. I just wanted to add, while we're talking kind of about the FMLA and the PFML and you know, supplemental benefit issues, because I see some questions on this, when they run concurrently. So if you have an employee who's out for baby bonding and that leave would be covered by both the PFML and the FMLA, and the employee's applied for both, the state has the rules indicate that you can't require employees to top off those benefits, those partial wage replacement benefits from the state. So you can't require that an employee use supplemental benefits if they're out on PFML leave, even if it's FMLA qualifying leave as well. That has been the state's position. Again, we don't have anything, any rules on that specifically, other than the draft rules about not requiring that employees are not required to use that supplemental benefit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think so that's a really good point, because I think, yeah, because most of you all probably have FMLA policies that say this leave is unpaid unless you have available PTO, which must be used, and you just can't do that if they're also receiving state benefits. And so we'll need to modify that language. And by the way, just while we're on that, we do know from one of our other favorite state rules, the paid sick leave, you can't force employees to use paid sick leave when they're on FMLA. So this is not related to the paid family leave, but just to put that out there, that the state has come down clearly on that now, that you can't force protected paid sick leave use while someone's on FMLA.
And so shifting gears away from that, there's a quick question. Are daughter-in-laws covered under PFML? Yes. So any in-laws that are covered, that would be daughters, son-in-laws, that would be parent-in-laws, that would be grandparent-in-laws. And so it's pretty widespread, the family members that are covered by this. And so just wanting to pull off a couple that aren't giving us headaches on the FMLA-PFML intersection.
Yeah. And actually, I see like three questions in a row about job protection. So just real quickly, so the FMLA, we all know if you're eligible for the FMLA, your job's protected, whether you take that first or at the same time as PFML. PFML has its own job protection if it's a large enough employer and the employee's been there for a year and basically meets the FMLA stuff, that's when PFML becomes protected. So you could have FMLA leave that's protected and then PFML. It's protected in its own right if you, regardless if you've exhausted FMLA. So, and that's going to happen in 2020, right? So January 1, I already used my 12 work weeks of FMLA in 2019. Now I'm applying for PFML benefits. If I meet the requirements, if the large enough employer had been there a year, 1,250 hours, my PFML leave that I'm going to take in 2020 is protected. You have to reinstate me. So, but if there's other times where folks will be eligible for PFML and it won't be protected because they don't work for a big enough employer, they've not been there long enough with you, that kind of thing. So there's two kind of versions of PFML leave. One's protected, one's not, depending on the employer and the employee. Let's see, what else? So did you just answer this, Kate? Is it a rolling year, a rolling 12 months, or a calendar year? It's rolling.
We will follow up on that. That's a good question. I don't know if this data allows you to determine that yourself. We can follow. We're going to do our follow-up Q&A webinar, though. There are some really, really great questions. I think there's still some confusion on whether or not PFML is protected leave. So kind of want to clarify that issue. If you are an employer that has less than 50 employees in Washington State, PFML never has job protection. You have to allow them to take it, but they don't have any job protection associated with that. If you have 50 or more employees that work in Washington State, that's when the job protection components of PFML kick in. And they're slightly different, as we've discussed, than FMLA. But just being mindful that the kind of step one is, do you have 50 or more employees in Washington? And then step two, there's other requirements to determine whether or not there's job protection. So where the FMLA really is a job protection benefits protection law, this is more of a funding mechanism to the state equivalent of FMLA. And so it's wage reimbursement, but not necessarily job protection. Hopefully that clarifies. Somebody weighed in and said it's rolling. So hopefully that person is right about the rolling year.
I thought that too. But yeah, it's always good to confirm.
I see a question about whether or not there's any exclusions for employees who have pre-existing conditions. And the answer is no. The state's going to evaluate eligibility. Is it a medical issue? Has the employee met the 820 hours? And they're going to grant leave if they meet that criteria. There's no exclusion for pre-existing conditions.
I know we're coming right up on 11 o'clock. One quick question. Can an employer add to their company policy that even though at 820 hours the state doesn't offer job protection, the internal policy could say that they would provide job protection for the leave? Absolutely. An employer may be more generous, and you can offer job protection if you choose to do so, even if the employee doesn't have it specifically under PFML. The one caution I would give is to make sure that if you're doing benefits protection, that you're doing that consistent with your health care policy so that you are not keeping them as an active employee on benefits when they're not entitled to benefits continuation. And so, yes, you can offer the job protection, but make sure you double check on the benefits eligibility if you intend to continue benefits as well. Jillian or Angela, you want to pick off one more quick one before we wrap up?
Two super quick ones. Intermittent leave, yes, you can take PFML on an intermittent basis in terms of an 8-hour increment. So if you have to be gone for a full 8 hours, you can get qualified for it. You can take an 8-hour absence this week, and maybe you need to go get a super, you know, cancer treatment the following week for 8 hours. Then, yes, you can take it on an intermittent basis. And then this other really quick one, there's a lot of questions about, like, well, how will we know if the employee's worked 820 hours in the state, or how will we know these things? I mean, technically, you don't really have to know that. I mean, they're going to go to the state and apply for benefits, and they're going to get them or they're not going to get them. And so, you know, the state will notify you if they've received those benefits. But it's not like when somebody gets hired, you need to know how much they've worked in the state necessarily. You need to evaluate whether they can be gone kind of on your own policies and your own laws, but whether they get those benefits is going to be between them and the state. But there'll be some back and forth between the state and the employer for sure.
And I would add to that, so the reporting portal for each employer entering in their Social Security number and some additional details about them. And so let's say Joe works for you, you enter in his Social Security number, he's worked 400 hours for you, another Washington employer, Joe works for them, they enter 500. The state's going to have that information, and I assume their portal will calculate out that he has met the qualifying hours requirement. And so that's why the reporting's really key for both employers that have voluntary plans and don't have voluntary plans. There's still reporting requirements so that the state can make the determination if they've met that 820 hours.
And I have one last question on my favorite, supplemental benefits. There's a question about whether or not an employer can deny PTO if an employee requests it and they're out on PFML. So here's the thing. The rule gives the employer the ability to provide those benefits. It's a choice. It's the employer's choice as to whether or not they want to provide supplemental benefits. Now, you're going to want to be consistent and offer them, you know, if you're going to offer them, you're going to want to offer them to all employees who are on PFML leave. But if you're deciding not to offer PTO to employees who are out on leave, that's just fine. That's a choice. It's not a legal requirement under the law.
All right. And we hope you join us for our Q&A webinar. We're
Because we realize that this format can be a little bit unsatisfying if you've got really specific questions. And so I think it'd be really great to have a follow-up where we really just kind of Q&A. And then, again, feel free to reach out to any of us directly, and we'll try to answer some questions as best we can, too. So we really appreciate y'all being here, and we look forward to seeing you virtually in the near future.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye. A link to an online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.